You know, fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, and some petty bureaucrats have to throw their weight around. I'm sure you've heard a few stories of petty bureaucrats determined to enforce the exact letter of the law, even when it makes no moral or ethical or even practical sense to do so. I've got a doozy of a story like that for you right now. This is the story of a bunch of rum runners who were sailing down the coast and got a distress call and went to rescue 9 shipwrecked sailors who would have died if they hadn't been rescued. Well, when they brought the sailors back to port, the rum runners got arrested and chucked in prison. Now, let me tell you all about it in just a second here. But first, I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Finn J.D. John, and I write a weekly newspaper column called Offbeat Oregon History. It runs in about a dozen newspapers around the state right now. You're listening to one of those columns right now from our archive. It was first run in the newspapers on December 27th, 2010. I'm going to read it to you now, and if you'd like some more information about this little podcast or about the newspaper column it's part of, stay tuned. Captain Robert Pamphlet and his crew were sailing south in a heavy sea when they heard the distress calls. The 579-ton steam schooner Kaoba, slugging it out with a gale off the mouth of the Columbia, had suffered a knockout blow. A wave had burst through a hatch and flooded the engine room, putting out the boiler fire. The ship was adrift, and it was filling with seawater. The crew had taken to the lifeboats. Pamphlet was in a perfect position to help, but there was just one problem. The hold of Pamphlet's 90-foot, 100-ton schooner, the Pescawa, was crammed with Scotch whiskey. And it was February 1st, 1925. Prohibition wouldn't end for another 8 years. Pamphlet and his crew were Canadian rum runners. At the time, this was a going business with big rewards and bigger risks. Cargo ships would leave British Columbia with a hold full of cheap liquor and head south, being careful to stay in the international waters 12 miles off the U.S. shore. Then, when they reached a prearranged rendezvous spot, they'd slip inside the 12-mile line under cover of darkness, unload the cargo into waiting trucks, and race back west to the safety of the open sea, and then north to start the process all over again. When it worked out, the job was great. But if the Pescawa were caught within that 12-mile boundary, Pamphlet and his crew would likely be sent to an American prison. So he was listening carefully to the radio to see if the crew of the Kaoba were getting rescued, hoping he wouldn't have to get involved. What he was hearing was at first reassuring. The tugboat John Kudahy had found and picked up a lifeboat with 9 men in it. But Pamphlet knew a freighter the size of the Kaoba would have more than 9 men on her crew. There had to be another lifeboat out there. Nobody else seemed to think so, though. Responding to the distress call, 2 other freighters had come to the Kaoba's aid. One after another, they tried diligently to get towing hawsers on the wallowing ship, ignoring the need to rescue its crew. Apparently, by this time, it had become obvious that because of the flotation of the lumber in its hold, the Kaoba was not going to sink after all. Now, crewless and adrift, ship and cargo belonged to whoever could get a line on her, under the law of salvage rights. So first the Forest King, and then the Thomas P. Beale came alongside and tried to take the stricken ship in tow. Then, having failed, they just went on their way. From Pamphlet's wheelhouse, it sounded like the scramble for those salvage rights was at the top of everyone's list, and the sailors on the second lifeboat, somewhere out there being tossed around in a gale if they hadn't already overturned and drowned, could just look out for themselves. Pamphlet got out his map and plotted wind direction and currents. Based on where the Kaoba was abandoned, as best he could know in those pre-Loran days, he figured out the patch of ocean in which the boat most likely was to be found. Then he gave the order to fall off the wind and sail due east. Eyes wide open, the Pescawa plunged into the 12-mile danger zone. After a search, the Canadians found the lifeboat right where Pamphlet had figured it would be and rescued its occupants. Sources differ on how many there were, 7 or 9, but it is known that the captain of the Kaoba was on this second lifeboat. The storm had apparently subsided by this time. Leaving the empty lifeboat, the Pescawa turned west and under full canvas hauled close to the southwest wind started for the open sea just as fast as she could go. It wasn't fast enough. The 1,181-ton 16-knot Coast Guard cutter Algonquin, which had also plotted the winds and currents, got to the scene a short time later and saw a sinister-looking black schooner, canvas virtually bursting as she raced westward. And it was all over for the Pescawa. Back to Astoria the schooner went at the heels of the Algonquin with a prize crew aboard and Pamphlet and his men under arrest. By the way, in case you're wondering how a 16-knot revenue cutter managed to actually catch up with the Pescawa, which couldn't possibly have had a lower maximum speed than 15 knots or so, even hauled close to the wind, most likely that's because the revenue cutter approached from the north, which would have been downwind. The schooner would not have been able to fall off and go into the wind. Although it did have a power plant, it wouldn't have been able to make 15 knots in under power. However, there are those who still say to this day that the Algonquin chased the Pescawa out into the international waters and actually made the arrest in international waters outside of its jurisdiction. We can't really know because of all the parties involved in the episode, none of them were exactly disinterested observers. Back to our story. When they arrived at Astoria, they were greeted by a cheering crowd, including the Caoba's entire crew. After all, it was only with a good bit of luck that the Pescawa found the tiny lifeboat bobbing in the sea. If Pamphlet and his men had stayed in safe waters, the Coast Guard cutter's chances of catching a similar lucky break and spotting them were not really high, and half of them might very well be dead. The popular show of support might have been gratifying, but it did not help the Canadians' cause. The cheering infuriated the district immigration officer. That would be the petty bureaucrat I mentioned at the beginning. This gentleman responded by jailing the Pescawa's crew and throwing everything he had at the men, including a charge of entering port without inspection and failure to carry the proper entry visa, which was a bit odd because they entered the port under compulsion and under arrest. In response, calls for clemency came from around the U.S. and Canada. The Canadians had put themselves in jeopardy to save these sailors after two big freighters turned their backs on them in an unlovely scramble for booty. It didn't seem right to most folks that the only people on the water that day who did the right thing should pay for their heroism with prison sentences. Furthermore, there was good reason to suspect that Pescawa had made it into the international waters, and that the Coast Guard cutter had made the arrest outside its jurisdiction. It wasn't enough. To prison they went. The rum runner's only statement after they were sentenced, as reported by Marshall in his book, was, quote, "Don't feel bad, mates. We did it, and we'd do it again to save a seaman's life." As for the Caoba, the lumber schooner for whose crew members the Pescawa's crew risked and gave all, the salvage attempts failed. The strong southwest wind blew her up on the coast of Washington, and she fetched up near Ocean Park. Today you can still find the ship's rusty boiler if you know where along the shore to look for it. Pamphlet died at age 59 in 1932, a few years after his release from prison. Though a solid, healthy specimen at the time of his capture, after 2 years in the federal hoosegow, his health was failing. The Pescawa came to a bad end as well. After a decade of weathering at a dock in Portland, she was sold to an Oregon City man named Victor Riley. Riley planned to use the Pescawa to sail to the Arctic and hunt whales. He recruited a crew of college students to help him and replaced the Pescawa's sturdy 100-horsepower Union Marine power plant with a 4-cylinder automobile engine scavenged from an old Maxwell. I haven't been able to learn exactly why they did this, but most likely it was because the marine engine had been sitting so long. Chances are it needed to be rebuilt before it would run, if it was even rebuildable. Then, as now, a good rebuild job cost a lot more than a used auto engine lugged home from the wrecking yard. Maxwell made its last car, by the way, in 1925, so this engine was at least 8 years old when Riley and company fired it up and pointed the Pescawa at the open sea in late February 1933. Well, this junkyard engine was simply not up to the task of muscling a 90-foot schooner around. On its way across the bar, at the moment it was most needed, the old flivver motor quit, and the storied old sailing ship was washed into the North Jetty. Captain Riley was killed in the crash, crushed against the rocks while trying to launch the lifeboat. The other crew members managed to swim to shore. That's the end of today's column. If you're listening for the first time, here's a little more information about this podcast and about Offbeat Oregon History, the newspaper column it's part of. Offbeat Oregon History tells the stories of Oregon history that nobody knows about, the ones everyone has forgotten. Stories of heroes and rascals, of shipwrecks and lost gold, of Shanghaied sailors and Skid Row bordellos and pirates and robbers and buried treasure and unsolved mysteries. We've got all of those things. It's a weekly column, and I've been writing it since late 2008. So right now there are about 175 published episodes in the kitty. So every weekday morning I pull one of those episodes up and put it out on the daily RSS feeds. One in text and pictures for your newsreader, and one in audio only for your podcatcher or for iTunes. You can read any archive column and subscribe to either daily feed by going to the website at offbeatoregon.com. Both feeds are optimized for smartphone or iPhone use, but they work great on an iPad, tablet, netbook, computer, whatever you got. All the columns are covered under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license. Thanks for listening, and do drop me a line if you're ever in Corvallis and have time for a cup of coffee. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. Have a great day.